At least Lawrence was dressed respectably now. Temeraire felt that there, at least, he had done his duty a little better. He had whispered a quiet word to Lady Allendale last night, and she had sent down some clothes from the house, a warm, thick cloak, and some of Lawrence's old things which had been given her to keep when Lawrence had been put in prison. It was not quite how Temeraire should have liked to see him dressed, but at least he had his sword again, and better boots, and a coat which fitted. Then Pagliettier landed, with four more yellow reapers, and a couple of grey coppers, hungry, and punished him by making his subterfuge quite real. They fell upon the porridge, were noisy and quarrelsome while eating, and when it was all gone she said belligerently, "And where will we eat to-morrow? No treasure, no food either. What are all your fine promises now?" He was rather taken aback to be so challenged, and said, "You needn't snap at me because we have lost a battle. After all, if Napoleon were so easy to beat, he would not have any treasure worth taking. So you must expect some difficulties, and I call it poor-spirited to begin to complain only because you were not clever enough to find yourself enough dinner last night."
"Oh, you did not talk of difficulties before," she said, "and you did not seem to think so much of Napoleon, either. If he has so much treasure, then it stands to reason he must be very difficult to beat, and perhaps we are not going to win at all."
"And if we do,"
a grey copper named Rictus said pointedly, raising his head out of the porridge-pit,
"I expect there will be no pavilions anyway, or treasure, not for us, or leastways not for those of us who haven't got our captains again and a place in the corps waiting for us any time we like. No, it'll be back to the breeding-grounds with us, and if we are only to end up as we began, I don't see why we are going about getting ourselves shot and clawed and flying across all creation hungry."
There was a low scattered murmur of agreement, and worse, several other dragons raising their heads in some interest to see how he would answer. Temeraire sat up angrily.
"I am not a sneak, and if you like to call me one you may say so at once, and plainly, instead of creeping about implying it."
"Well, what do you mean to do when we have won?" Ballista said, having listened in so far. "Rictus isn't wrong to say that you needn't worry about the rest of us any more. You are not unharnessed any more, even if you haven't much of a crew to speak of."
Temeraire flattened his ruff at this last remark. After all, he had Gong Su back now, and Dorset, even if Dorset was not quite so desirable as Keynes, and, of course, Emily and Amain and Sifo, and Fellows and Blythe, and even Allen, so he had a perfectly respectable number, which in any case had nothing to do with the matter.
"You had a crew before, and might have one again yourself, and so might any of us," he pointed out. "So the question is not whether one is in harness, but whether one may choose to be or not. And if it is only a choice between being in harness or being in the breeding grounds, that is not enough of a choice at all, when the breeding grounds are so boring. And that is the case even if one is in harness for the moment."
"Yes, but,"
Ballista said, and then paused until Magistratus, lying next to her, said bluntly,
"Look, old worm, we're all doing what you say. So what if they should offer you something you want, if only you keep us quiet and fighting with the rest of the harnessed fellows? We all know they want to hang your captain. What if they should offer you his life?"
Temeraire paused in his turn.
"Well, I'm not going to let them hang Lawrence, no matter what," he said, with a hasty glance to be sure he had not been overheard. "But I do see. They might offer me a very large pavilion, or a great deal of gold."
He rubbed a talon back and forth over his forehead thoughtfully.
"It would not be fair," he said at last, "if I took anything that should be for me only, when I should be getting it not for my own work but for all of ours. We are all sharing. So perhaps," he added, "one of you had better come along when I go and talk to the generals again, one of the little ones who can go all about and let everyone know what it is they will give us."
"I will come along," Minnow said. "I have never been harnessed, and I don't look to be ever, so no one can say I am inclined to go soft on them. Anyway, I would like to see a general. I never have."
Temeraire stretched his head over to ask Lawrence and Admiral Roland who was presently in command and where they might be, which he thought quite a straightforward question.
"Well, it isn't," Admiral Roland answered him. "It is still Dalrymple for the moment, I suppose, but he is likely to be replaced as soon as we get to Scotland and government have a chance to take him out of harm's way. Our harm, that is. If there is a lick of sense among them, it shall be Wellesley in his place, but we ought not put our hopes so high."
"But then who am I to talk to?" Temeraire said. "I do not like to say so, but the others are not quite happy. After all our hard work, we have lost and got no treasure,
and they would like to know what use it is to keep on. Not,' he added hastily, in case Lawrence or Admiral Roland should think that he was a poor officer, "'that we have no discipline. But after all, they are not harnessed, so they wonder why we are helping so much.' Lawrence was silent a moment, and then he said, "'We may as well speak to Wellesley. It cannot much matter who we have made arrangements with, if the war is lost.' Admiral Roland nodded and said, "'I will tell you. Now we have got the guns out of the way, I meant to send some of us back anyway to cover the infantry when they come out of Whedon. It is too close to London, and Bonaparte has too many dragons by half. I think I have worked out where he is getting them from,' she added. "'He is using unharnessed beasts, too, pulled out of his own breeding grounds.' I dare say that Celestial of his can talk them out of their caves as well as Temeraire can ours.
I do not see that she needed to go to any special effort, Temeraire said with feeling, when Napoleon is doing everything nice and giving his dragons, pavilions, and treasure too, I expect. I am sure no one is complaining to her.
Admiral Roland snorted.
Well, whether she has had much work or not, I am confident this is the best explanation for how he has laid hands on 100 spare dragons in so little time. He hasn't taken a single beast off his eastern borders at all, and that means he can afford to spend a few dozen of them to harry our foot on the march.
Lawrence nodded, and Temeraire saw the danger plainly. With the infantry walking to Scotland, they would be an easy target on the road for aerial assault, and going at their creeping pace of 20 miles a day would be in striking range of dragons headquartered at London for a week.
The unharnessed beasts can less easily be taken by boarding if Bonaparte should manage to put together some clever little strike, she went on. So it would be just as well to make Temeraire's regiment the guard, and let him hash this out with Wellesley before we have a mutiny on our hands. I haven't the right to promise them anything, and you may be sure if I did, their lordships wouldn't abide by it. And if you do secure them any pay, she added dryly, pray be sure it comes to the harnessed dragons, too. I am sure Exidium would not say no to a little treasure of his own.
"'It seems a great bother to me to be flying back,'
Armatius grumbled, when Temeraire had brought back the news. He did not much like always carrying Gentius around, but he was the least manoeuvrable of the heavyweights, save Requiescat, so it fell to him nearly all the time.
"'At least you do not need to carry a gun, too, in this direction,' Temeraire said. "'And flying slower, we will be able to find more food. "'Anyway, we are going to go arrange for our pay, "'which is like treasure that is given you every month "'without your having to work for it, so you cannot complain.'
"'Except the harnessed dragons sharing the park with them, "'who were disgruntled at not being allowed to come along "'and get some pay themselves.
"'Well, I am going back with you,'
Iskierka announced, "'and would not be dissuaded, no matter what Granby said.' And to Temeraire's deep disgust, Admiral Roland finally said, "'No, it is just as well, Granby. She will only fuss lying about in Scotland or going on patrol.' But despite this setback, it was in any case satisfying to be flying back south, even though they were not to stay, because it felt to Temeraire a little as though they were reclaiming their territory, or at least refusing to acknowledge it was not theirs any more. He still did not like to fall back all the way to Scotland, no matter how much more secure it should be for regrouping, but if they must do it, at least they should not have run there directly from the battlefield with the French dragons on their heels all the way. And perhaps they would even have a little fighting if the French tried to attack the infantry on the march. Whedon was visible aloft from a long way. The walls of the depot were built of thick grey blocks of granite, with tall, narrow turrets at each corner reaching far into the air, bristling with pepper guns. Around the walls, enormous stands of long halberds and arrowhead spears had been planted on the ground in lines, so a great company of men might sleep safe from aerial assault, and the remnants of the infantry and cavalry were bivouacked among them. It did not look at all comfortable to attack, and, thanks to the defences, Temeraire had to lead everyone else to land all the way on the far side of the camp. Wellesley came the long distance out to speak to them with no good grace, especially as he had to walk most of the way.
"'What the devil are you doing here? You ought to be nearly to Scotland by now, and half my cavalry are in fits.' "'We are here to protect you,' Temeraire said, injured, "'and also to talk to you about pay and our rights, since we did not win treasure.'
"'Why, damn you, you can wait to bring the lawyers into it until we have run the French out,' Wellesley said. "'Good God, you may be sure Bonaparte does not have to argue his way through every battle.'
"'If you would like to be compared to him,' Temeraire said, Then Bonaparte has also made a marketplace in Paris for his dragons, and built them pavilions. And he is not penning them up in breeding grounds either, if they do not like to be there.
Lawrence laid a hand on Temeraire's leg, and Temeraire swallowed the rest of his remarks. It was difficult to remember that one must be respectful to a senior officer, even if the senior officer was unpleasant in return, and to have to think carefully about what one said instead of laying everything out plainly, even if it was perfectly obvious and fair.
"Sir," Lawrence said, "we have been ordered to cover your retreat,"
and handed Wellesley the note from Admiral Roland, a brief scrawl in her bad handwriting which Temeraire could not quite read from overhead. Wellesley scowled through the explanation, and then he crumpled the note and pitched it away. One of his aides hastily retrieved it out of the mud behind his back, to be sure it did not lie about to be picked up.
"That woman is more to be relied on than half the general's staff. It is a damned embarrassment. So this Chinese beast is managing Bonaparte's dragons for him. How did he get the creature to obey him in the first place? He was not there for her hatching."
"She is snobbish, so I suppose she liked that he is an emperor," Temeraire said, "and that he should make it easy for her to be nasty to me. She is a very unpleasant sort of dragon."
"I think perhaps you dislike her too greatly to be just, Temeraire," Lawrence said, and to Wellesley said, "Sir, she had lately lost her companion before coming to France, and being bereft was perhaps more vulnerable to a kindness which ordinarily pride would have armoured her against. But Bonaparte has not won her by any trick, but with a high degree of real affection, and certainly all the outward shows of respect, and he has materially altered the conditions for dragons under his rule for the better."
"So anyone can manage a dragon, then, if you bribe the creature properly and cosset it like a woman," Wellesley said.
Temeraire laid his ruff back. He did not think he was unjust to Lien at all, himself, but he did see that, of course, Lawrence's explanation was the more important one for their own case, and even Lien was not just helping Napoleon because he had given her a few presents. Not that Temeraire would have said no to a diamond as handsome as the one she had been wearing at the Battle of Jena. But that was after she had decided to help.
"It is not bribery or cosseting if you pay someone what they deserve, and if they do not like to help you otherwise."
"It is a good £2,000 to feed a beast your size for a year," Wellesley said. "Do you expect more?"
"Then give me the £2,000, Temeraire said, "and I will undertake to feed myself, and put aside some of the rest, as I like."
"Ha!" Wellesley said. "And when you gamble it away, and are starving, and you steal a cow to eat, then what is to be done with you?"
"Of course I would not gamble with treasure," Temeraire said repressively. "If I wanted to take someone else's treasure, I would fight them. And if I did not want to fight them, then I would not want to take it with a game anyway, because if I did win, then of course they would want to fight to get it back afterwards."
"And I suppose every other dragon has as much sense," Wellesley said.
"If you prefer it, sir," Lawrence said, "you may pay them their board and a wage above it. The form matters little. The question at hand is whether you will agree they have a right to pay, and all the same rights and liberties under which any man serves."
"Why the devil ask me?" Wellesley said. "Go speak to Dalrymple if you like. I have no authority to make commitments on behalf of government."
Lawrence said, "Sir, you are likely to be appointed to the command and to just that authority. We both know that their lordships are not likely to overrule in the broad strokes what commitments you feel necessary to make to secure so critical a victory, nor even question them greatly if those commitments should deliver to the effort a substantial force of dragons which otherwise have no inclination to remain and to serve."
Wellesley tapped his boot again, and said nothing for a moment, looking at Lawrence.
"I can give you my word it will be considered, shall we say," he offered. "And I can promise your beast the £2,000 per annum directly, as he is so sure he may be trusted. And we need hear nothing more of your own difficulties."
"Ha!" Minnow said, putting her head over Temeraire's shoulder. "Just so. They are offering you something only for you and your captain." Wellesley started back. He had evidently not noticed Minnow sitting quietly on Temeraire's back, listening in.
"Yes, but I am not going to take it," Temeraire said, and lowered his head more closely, so Wellesley had to look at him directly. "I do not choose to wait and rely on generosity. I know perfectly well how generous their lordships are. If you would like our help now, then you may say how much it is worth to you, also now, and if it is not as much as I think it worth, I will tell the others so, and they will leave, I expect. I will stay myself for Lawrence, but I will not keep the others for my own personal sake. And it is not very handsome of you to propose anything so insulting either," he added reproachfully, lifting his head back away, "when you know I cannot fight you over it, because you are too small."
"Do you know, you're the most damned peculiar pair of traitors I have ever heard of," Wellesley said to Lawrence. "Are you trying to get yourself into Fox's Book of Martyrs?"
Temeraire snorted angrily. Lawrence had read him bits of that book, and it was all about people who had died in especially unpleasant ways. But Lawrence only said,
"Sir, there are abundant proofs for any man by now that any nation which gives its dragons liberty and brings them into the life of the state, winning their loyalty direct and not merely by intermediaries, must profit by it to so great an extent that no enemy which does not follow the same course can long hope to mount an aerial force to compete with them. If you do not care to learn from the example of China..."
One of the young officers on Wellesley's staff, who had walked out with him, made a rude noise.
"You need not sniff either," Temeraire said. "China may not have so many guns as here, but there are thousands of dragons in the army."
"Thousands indeed,"
Wellesley said, skeptically.
6,288, my mother told me," Temeraire said.
No one said anything a moment, and he supposed it might seem odd to be so precise, so he explained.
"Because that is a lucky number. Of course they have more dragons who can fight, but those dragons are not officially in the army."
"And if," Lawrence said to Wellesley, "the population of France is not so great as that of China, if they should even achieve the same proportion of dragons to men and arable land, using the same techniques of husbandry which, you may be sure, Lien has conveyed to Bonaparte, their nation will shortly be able to field a military force of 1,000. Would you care to face that in 5 years, with the corps at its present rate of growth?"
"Damn you! I am not in a mood to be lectured at with figures as though I were in a boardroom in Whitehall," Wellesley said. "Very well. Your beasts will have their keep, and above that, the same wages as any other man in service under the Navy Board."
"A shilling a day will keep a seaman's wife and children, and let him carouse on shore a little when he comes into port. It will not do much for a dragon," Lawrence said.
"And we don't want little coins we must keep track of either and cannot hold on to," Minot put in. "A proper mess that would be."
Temeraire nodded.
"No, and what we really want is to be able to go where we like. That is what I want promised also. If we may go where we like and do any work that is offered to us, then even should government offer us unfair wages, we will work for someone else instead. And the same for harnessed dragons, too," he added.
"Any work that is offered to you?"
Wellesley said.
"By all means. As for going where you like..."
He and Lawrence wrangled a long time in low voices over sums and coverts, and how much ought to be paid to a heavyweight, over a courier, and so on. Temeraire listened carefully, but he did not know all the places which Lawrence named where coverts ought to be, and also he was not quite certain about the money. His breastplate, he knew, was worth nearly £10,000, but shillings and pence were new. They were interrupted at last only by the arrival of a breathless courier from the main camp, to inform them that the last stragglers from the battlefield had been regrouped, and were ready to begin the march to the north.
"I have no more time for this," Wellesley said. 20 coverts on the Bath Road and the Great North Road, where they can go to sleep and be fed. As for pavilions, they can build the damned things themselves with their own shillings. Set themselves up like admirals, if they like. And after this, they had damn well better keep in line."
"Sir,"
Lawrence said, and made a bow. To Wellesley's back. The general had already turned and walked away. Lawrence found himself almost at once the centre of a large and interested audience of dragons, all pressing in and jostling for room to hear him, as soon as he had begun to try and explain to Temeraire and Minnow the system of coinage.
"So 10 pounds will buy a cow," Minnow said intently, "and a pound and a shilling is a bit of gold?"
"If it is 20 shillings to a pound, and 24 shillings a day," Temeraire said thoughtfully, "then that is nearly £400 a year for a heavyweight."
Performing calculations in his head, which produced a buzz of satisfaction among the other dragons.
"But where is it?" Iskierka demanded. "I did not come back to just hear numbers. What sort of treasure is that?"
Temeraire snapped at her a little.
"It is reliable treasure," he said. "Not all of us want to be always running around picking quarrels and making difficulties like you, all to grab more and more. This is for everyone every day who does their duty, like proper soldiers, and it is fair."
The other dragons were generally of his mind, if Ischiaca continued to sulk, and agreed they were satisfied with their lot. But Lawrence himself felt not a little disgusted on having stooped to such backroom negotiations at such a moment, manoeuvring for personal interest, while Bonaparte marched into London and the French followed on their heels, felt more like treason to him than any of the acts for which he had been charged.
"We must see to your dinners," he said,
more out of an urgent wish to put an end to the gloating noise.
"The army will march at first light, and we must be ready."
In the morning, when the dragons had breakfasted and gone aloft, the first regiments were already out on the road, their pace sluggish enough that Requiescat remarked near dinner-time,
"Now this is what I call a pleasant flight. No fussing or hurry."
Temeraire only sighed.
"We might go over to them, and offer to carry them at least a little way, as many as could climb aboard us," he suggested to Lawrence. "I am sure they could go faster."
"Not without orders," Lawrence said.
He could well imagine Wellesley's reaction, or Dalrymple's, if the dragons should begin to fly towards the ranks, and likely panic some of the men and cavalry beasts into running after all the difficulty in forming them back into their regiments.
"It is only so dull. We might fly to tonight's rendezvous and back again three times over before they have got there,"
Temeraire said.
"And some of us more than that. What if Requiescat and a few of the others should stay pacing them and we go ahead? Or perhaps," he added, Ruff coming up with enthusiasm, "we might go back and see if we cannot pay Napoleon back a little for everything which he has done."
He peered back over his shoulder to see how this was received.
"It is not your place even to propose such a thing any more," Lawrence said. "You have accepted a commission. You are obliged to preserve discipline, not to undermine it."
Hearing himself thus condemned from his own mouth, Lawrence abruptly stopped. He did not know how to speak to Temeraire of duty any more without being a hypocrite.
"I suppose," Temeraire said regretfully, "it is not always so pleasant to be an officer. And I am sure Ischiaca will complain all night, and say more cutting things about going slowly and running away and not getting treasure."
He snorted and looked, and then said doubtfully,
"Where is Ischiaca?"
She had been flying sullenly to their rear all the morning, amusing herself by occasional wild darts into the heavy, low clouds above, where her flames made gold and crimson and purple flashes through the white and grey, like a sunset in mid-morning. But Lawrence did not remember her doing it the last 2 hours and more. Arcady was gone also, with a handful of the other ferals, and when questioned, Ringe had a guilty twist to her neck, even while she professed surprise and confusion. Temeraire did not miss it either.
"But how am I to make Ringe tell me where they have gone?"
he asked Lawrence, and batted her reaching talons away from a bleating sheep. He had brought them down in a broad meadow, the better to interrogate the remaining ferals, and the other dragons were driving the luckless resident herd in towards them all, so they should make a meal while they worked out what Ischiaca and the others had done.
"No, you may not eat until you have told me. They have made a great deal of trouble for all of us."
"I call that hard," Requiescat said, mumbling around a sheep. "It ain't as though we will not outstrip those redcoats anyhow, and nobody minds a snack either."
"You may find it less pleasant when we have had to fly 30 miles back to catch Ischiaca up, and then 60 on to the rendezvous,"
Lawrence said grimly. And that was the very best outcome they could hope for.
"Hum,"
Requiescat said, licking his chops thoughtfully.
"That's so. But I don't see as we have to go finding her at all. She and those fellows know where the rendezvous is as well as anyone, and they have some men and their compasses with them, if they should get themselves lost, like hatchlings. We can just go on and let them catch us up."
"They must know we would miss them after they had been gone so long," Temeraire said, "so I expect that they have got themselves into a fight and are probably all dying somewhere full of French bullets."
He did not sound as though he would be very sorry to find as much the case. Ringe squirmed as Temeraire pointedly translated this for her, but still said nothing.
"Temeraire," Lawrence said low, "it is not only foolishness on her part. This is a challenge to your authority."
"Oh,"
Temeraire said, and having told Ringe as much, he added,
"So now you will tell me, or else."
And when she continued mute, he drew a great expanding breath and roared out over her head.
"Payom je rung,"
Ringe said, flattening herself to the ground, and everyone jumped. A gentle pattering like rain came from the trees in the path of Temeraire's roar, old acorns shaken loose into the dead leaves, and a few small birds dropping stone dead. Gong Su promptly went in after them, while Ringe muttered her confession. The miscreants had gone back towards London with a notion of taking some of Napoleon's army by surprise, winning either treasure or accolades. There had been no very well-formed goal. They had gone looking for a fight as much as for any practical reward.
"We ought to go on and leave them to catch up,"
Temeraire said, panting a little, still ruffled and angry.
"Just as Requiescat says. Except then I dare say she will come back with two eagles or something like, and there will be no living with her at all."
Lawrence did not like to ill-wish aloud, but if Ischiaca had so overridden Granby as to make herself a deserter, she was unlikely to be guided in any other respect of sense, and he thought Temeraire's earlier expectation was the more likely to be met. But Temeraire brightened after a moment and said,
"Anyway, I do not suppose anyone can blame us for going after her to fetch her back, Lawrence. After all, she is very important, or so everyone says."
The roads beneath them were empty as they flew back towards London, warily and quick. The haze of dust which the British soldiers raised had already settled, and no sign of French pursuit. No one much was to be seen out of doors except farmers and herdsmen at their husbandry. Cattle and crops cared nothing for Napoleon or politics, and implacably demanded all the same attention. But even these few men kept their heads low, and hurried through their work as much as could be done. By late afternoon the countryside seemed nearly deserted, with the sun yearning impatiently to its rest.
"We ought to see her miles off if she is showing away as she always does," Temeraire was saying ungraciously as they flew,
and then he pricked up his ruff. A small speck in the distance, coming closer, had emerged from the clouds and begun to resolve itself into wings. It was Gurney, a much battered Gurney, panting with the speed of her flight, and her face mazed with a trickle of blood she ineffectually tried to rub off against her shoulder now and again, only smearing it about into a brick-red film overlaid on her blue hide. Tharkay was with her, and he leapt down to Temeraire's back from hers mid-flight, like a boarder, but tethered by a long double strap of thick leather. He unclipped it from his own waist as soon as he had landed and latched onto Temeraire's harness. Gurney caught up the snapping, free, loose end, which jangled loudly with small clapperbells, and wrapped it around her own forearm a few times.
"What is that?"
Temeraire said, with interest, craning his head to see.
"I had it made in Istanbul, my last journey,"
Tharkay said, and to Lawrence said,
"Ischiaca has been taken."
He led them to Arcady, and the other deserters huddled and licking their wounds in the shelter of a tall hill that shielded them from the road, casting an afternoon shadow long enough to conceal them from cursory observation from aloft. The red-patched Ferrel roused when Temeraire came into land, and mantled his wings defensively.
"That is enough. You shan't bristle at me," Temeraire said. "You knew very well you were behaving like a—" He
paused for consideration.
"Like a scrub, or else you shouldn't have sneaked. And if you have been served out as you deserved, it is no one's fault but your own. You had better to be sorry, and promise not to do it again, than hiss."
"They broke away a little before noon,"
Tharkay told Lawrence, as they squatted down and scraped clean a patch of dirt for him to sketch out the action.
"Well managed. They had been going into the clouds all morning, and making a noise with their singing. So by the time we realized they had turned us around, you were all far out of earshot. Granby's gunners shot off a few flares, but it was a hopeless effort. From there our luck was as evil as it might have been. 2 hours flying towards London without any challenge, so we were on Bonaparte's doorstep by the time we came on any other beasts, and then it was Davout's advance guard out gathering cattle, 2 Grand Chevaliers, and another 6 heavyweights. Of course all of them went directly for her. I think I saw 60 men jump for her back at once. Arcady grew remarkably less deaf to me after that, and we managed to get away, but the French already had Granby trussed like a chicken on one of the chevaliers, and were racing him away as fast as they could go, with Ischiaca flinging herself madly after them."
"I knew I ought never to have let her have Granby,"
Temeraire said stormily.
"Now look how she has lost him, and not even in a real battle. We ought to get him back, and leave her to them, and good riddance."
Lawrence exchanged a glance with Tharkay. It was by no means good riddance to lose their one fire-breather to the French, no matter how recalcitrant.
"Did you see where they went?"
Lawrence asked, low,
"'Straight for London,' Tharkay said.
Chapter 10
"'I am an officer now, though,' Temeraire said, "'so I do not see why I must wait.'
"'You might be a general, and it will not make you any smaller,' Lawrence said. "'A 20-ton dragon must give over trying to sneak, "'and that is our only hope at all of getting Granby out.'
"'But what if you should be captured?' Temeraire said. "'And then I would be just as bad as Iskierka. "'It is my duty to keep you safe.'
"'They had fought very nearly this same battle before, however, in Istanbul, "'and his protests were rather an expression of unhappiness "'than fresh and determined objections.
"'We have not time to quarrel. "'Granby's very life, if not his liberty, may depend on quick action,' "'Lawrence said gently.
"'And Temeraire sank to his belly with his ruff pinned back.' "'Threshing the matted straw of the meadow uneasily with his claws, "'and raking up dust and furrowed earth with it. "'Lawrence was grateful for the established habit of the conversation, "'if a little guilty, for it allowed him to practice a degree of deceit. "'He knew under ordinary circumstances he would not in this same situation go, "'however much he might wish to. "'If he were captured, Temeraire would be prisoner, "'and in their already dire straits the risk could not be run.' Not for so slim a chance as they faced to bring out Granby and Iskierka. The circumstances were not ordinary. Lawrence was a man already dead in law. He could not value preserving his own life very high, and so long as he were killed instead of captured in the attempt, which he had some right to hope might be arranged, Temeraire would not be lost to Britain. He had made the agreement with Wellesley, and now was bound directly, not only through Lawrence himself. And there was no one else to go. Iskierka had been the only one of their motley company with a proper crew, and all of them had been captured with her, lieutenants, midwing men, even her ground crew all aboard. All that were left now were Lawrence's small handful of crew, and for senior officers, only Dunn and Wickley, former midwing men of Lawrence's crew, who had acquired enough of the Ferrol's language to be useful as translators. A handful of other officers had been similarly placed with the Ferrol's for a gift with languages more than any other quality. Most of them were young, very young, nearer 14 than 20, and not to be sent on an expedition little better than a dice-throw. Tharkay shook his head at the lot of them and said to Lawrence,
"'Better if we go alone.'
Tharkay had taken a commission with the corps, at least for the moment, but this was not something which any service could require.
"'You are not obliged,' Lawrence began.
"'No,' Tharkay agreed civilly, with one raised brow. And Lawrence bowed and left it there. Lawrence exchanged his bottle-green coat for Blythe's leather smock, with its pockets large enough to conceal a multitude of sins, two pistols and a good knife and one of Blythe's hammers. Tharkay gave him a handful of dirt to apply to his face, already rubbing more into his own hands and beneath his nails. Dunn watched their preparations at a distance, sidelong and hesitating, with occasional glances at the other officers. But he did not say anything. It was not cowardice. He had made sufficient proof of his courage in previous service that Lawrence did not doubt it now. Dunn's reluctance had a source less palatable. Plainly, he did not wish to serve with Lawrence again. There could be no harm to Dunn's career from such cooperation here. Some, indeed, might occur if he chose not to go and Lawrence did not return, so the objection was one of principle. Lawrence bent his head over the fresh loading of his pistols and did not see more of Dunn's struggle than he had to. The sense of disapproval did not weigh upon him so greatly now. He felt himself a righted ship, heaved off her beam ends and into a course dangerous, but for the immediate distance clear, even if there was a lee shore off his bows and impenetrable murk ahead. He might be dashed on rocks if the wind turned against him, but at least for the moment he knew what must needs be done, and he was free to do it. They were ready in less than 10 minutes, and would have gone at once, but Gong Su came and offered them a makeshift plate of bark with two small skewers upon it, tiny hearts and liver, still steaming from a makeshift butchering, and raw. Lawrence regarded it with dismay.
"'A little of the divine wind inside,' Gong Su explained.
They had come from the birds which Temeraire had inadvertently slain.
"'That makes a good fortune.'
Lawrence was not superstitious, but he ate. They could hardly refuse any advantage whatsoever. Tharkay took his own dose, pulled up the hood of his cloak over his face, and they went out to the road.
"'They may already have sent Granby to France, of course,' Tharkay said to him in Chinese,
while he sat in the back of a drover's cart.
"I hope not risk the Navy,"
Lawrence said, fumbling in his turn through the difficult language which he knew he made nearly unintelligible, despite Temeraire's many despairing attempts to correct his pronunciation. It at least gave them a privacy nearly impossible to breach, even by the hungry curiosity of the drover, who for a couple of quiet shillings had agreed to take them along to market with the cattle the man hoped to sell before they should be confiscated. Tharkin nodded. If Napoleon were sure enough of his grip on London, or at least upon enough of it to establish a prison, he might choose rather to be safe and keep his valuable captive penned within it instead of risking Granby's death in a crossing under fire, and the resulting frenzy of a Kazilik unleashed upon his forces. They could hope for at least a brief delay, while the question was considered, during which Granby would be held nearby. They had to hope, otherwise there was no chance at all. The last two crawling miles to the city were infuriating, when they had flown 50 this morning in what seemed less time, and the outskirts of London sounded already like a province of France. Tens of thousands of soldiers were busy making encampments, calling to one another and to the dragons who were helping them dig ditches and move stones and even widen roads, and those local shop boys, more industrious than patriotic, were running up and down the lanes of the camp, plying food and more commonly drink in high, carrying voices and awkward, badly accented bits of French.
"Un franc, monsieur,"
and
"S'il vous plaît."
But they were already improving.
"He is not shy of permanent alterations," Tharkay said, indicating with a jerk of his chin the buildings which were being put up.
Large stones were being laid into the ground and pressed down by dragons, to make a raised platform once mortar had been poured over and between them and logs sunk at the corners. There were no walls to the shelters, but as they came nearer the city, Lawrence saw one already finished and in use, dragons sleeping on three sides, and soldiers crammed into the sheltered space between them. They would sleep warm despite the coming winter, warmer than the British soldiers would. The work bore all the hallmarks of a long occupation. Napoleon was not planning any immediate campaign, Lawrence realized grimly, but rather to entrench himself, and to let time and use dull the intolerable into the everyday. The lowing cows plodded along after the cart, driven on by the drover's boys, the sour grassy smell and the dust of the road rising up thick around them. Their shillings and tried patience did at least buy them an easy entry into the city. The French sergeant on duty on the Aldersgate Road brightened at the sight of the cattle, and waved them in with only a cursory question or two for the farmer and his companions, pointing them towards Smithfield and the slaughterhouses. Lawrence and Tharkay stayed in the cart a little longer, until it had turned a corner towards the marketplace, the herd and the boys momentarily out of sight. Then Tharkay touched Lawrence's elbow, and, quick and unannounced, they slipped from the back of the cart and into a narrow alleyway. Newgate Prison was their target. A few coins at a pub bought Lawrence a healthy dose of gossip and rumour, most of it worthless and irrelevant but for the information that Bonaparte was staying in Kensington Palace, and
"that unnatural white beast of his lying in Hyde Park like some overgrown eel, with those horrid red eyes,"
and much shuddering all around. Tharkay had better fortune, if so it could be called. Some prisoners were indeed being kept at the prison, but there had been no new arrivals today. Not that anyone had seen, and without prompting they had mentioned Iskierka's appearance in particular. She had been seen in Hyde Park also, and eating two cows and setting the entire city ablaze, if some of the reports were to be believed. But one street sweeper at least swore that no British aviators or crew had been brought to Newgate that day.
"In consolation," Tharkay said, "neither have they been shipped to the coast. No large dragons have gone since she came in, and certainly he has not been sending anyone by boat." "He might have Granby in Kensington Palace,"
Lawrence said after a moment.
"It would be very convenient for us, certainly," Tharkay said dryly.
"It sounds like folly, I know," Lawrence said. "But if I may be pardoned for forming an opinion on the grounds of one meeting, I would say that Bonaparte is unreasonably fond of seduction, to the point that he likes to believe he has a chance of persuasion where rationally anyone would see there is none. He will never miss a chance for a grand gesture if he thinks he might coax Granby into service."
Tharkay listened and shrugged.
"We may as well take the chance. The trail is cold otherwise."
It was dark by the time they reached the outskirts of Mayfair. Here and there the life of the city continued at a muted tone, alehouses spilling warmth, and the smell of fresh beer onto the dirty cobbles, and firelight gleamed from behind closed shutters, those who had not fled the city, whether from unwillingness or from inability. In the fashionable section, Lawrence took the lead from Tharkey. These streets he knew well, going past his father's house and those of his friends and political acquaintance, of men Lawrence had known in the Navy, all of them shuttered and dark. Lawrence did not hesitate. He had expected silence, abandoned houses, perhaps even wreckage and looting. He moved on steadily, and did not look to see what damage might have been done until he came into Dover Street, and was at last surprised to find it crammed with carriages. 10 linkmen standing at the door of one great town-house, fine young ladies and their chaperones, British gentlemen, French officers, all going up the stairs, and a great bustling noise of music and laughter and dish-clattering spilling down. He stopped in the street, appalled, and had to be drawn back from the lights by Tharkey.
"We will not get past that soon," Tharkey said.
Lawrence did not immediately answer, too choked with anger. He had never been a visitor in the house, but thought it was let to a member from Liverpool, a man who might have voted with his father on occasion. Lawrence mastered himself and drew Tharkey along the street a few doors to another house, still occupied, but quietly so. A few subdued lights gleaming out from between shutters, not a party to welcome the conquerors. Waiting by the gate, they might pass for footmen or grooms, and be dismissed from notice. With any luck, the owner and his family were already abed. They stood nearly an hour, stamping a little to warm their feet, and drawing back against the sides of the house now and then as another carriage reached the door to disgorge its passengers. Every minute brought a fresh cause for indignation, the smell of hot beef, a burst of singing in French, a lady waltzing with a French officer past the open balcony doors. The carriages thinned out only a little over the course of their wait, a sad crush, with the king fled to Scotland, and thousands of British soldiers dead and prisoner. And then a troop of horses came down the street, old guard, in their tall hats and pomp, shouting to clear the way and muscling the remaining carriage horses aside with cool indifference to the protests of their drivers, making room for the great coach to come rolling along through the crush, an eagle painted in gold upon the door. It drew up before the house, and through the ranks of guards lined up the stairs, Lawrence saw Napoleon emerge from the carriage and mount up to the house. In trousers and Hessian boots, and a long leather coat, more suited to mid-air than a drawing-room, though splendid with gold braid and buttons, and dyed richly black. Another man was beside him, one of the marshals. Murat, Lawrence thought, the Emperor's brother-in-law. They went up the stairs together, and applause welcomed them inside.
"Disgusting," a man said,
nearby, low, and Lawrence started and looked around. While he had been watching the spectacle, two gentlemen had descended a carriage at the very door of the house where he stood. They were presently between him and Tharkey, who had drawn back a little into the shadow of the house.
"Do you know, I heard Lady Hamilton was going to attend?"
"Her and half the other women of quality left in the city,"
the second gentleman answered him, a voice vaguely familiar.
"You there?" the man raised his voice to address Lawrence. "What do you mean, loitering on the street, gawking as though you were at a play? They don't need any damned encouragement."
And Lawrence, in sinking sense of disaster, recognised him. Bertram Woolvey, a distant acquaintance and the son of a friend of Lord Allendale's. Woolvey had married Edith Gallman, if any better cause were needed for lack of love between him and Lawrence, but they had never been friends even before that event. Woolvey was a gamester and a spendthrift, with the one saving grace that he could afford to be, and their circles had always been very different. Lawrence knew nothing good of him besides his choice of a wife. And now Woolvey was stepping closer, frowning at the lack of an answer. Lawrence was out of the street-light circle, and his face obscured by the smudged dirt he had applied, but in a moment he should be recognised, and all at an end. The slightest outcry would bring 10 men from the guards outside the party, whether Woolvey meant to draw them down on him or not. Lawrence took 2 quick steps to Woolvey's side, and gripped him by the arm, covered his mouth with another hand.
"Say nothing,"
he said, hissed and low, to Woolvey's staring eyes.
"Do you understand? Say nothing. Not if you understand me."
Woolvey's companion said,
"What are you—"
and stopped. Tharkey had caught him from behind and clapped a hand over his mouth also. Woolvey nodded,
and when Lawrence took away his hand, said at once,
"William Lawrence, what the devil are you?"
and had to have his mouth covered again. The door of the house opened, a footman looking out, puzzled.
"Into the house," Lawrence said. "Quickly, for God's sake!"
and half pushed Wolvie up the stairs before they should draw attention. The footman backed in at a loss before their awkward rush. Tharkey and Wolvie's companion, a gentleman Lawrence vaguely recognised, a Mr. Sutton Leeds, directly on Lawrence's heels. Tharkey let go Sutton Leeds as soon as they were inside and snatched the door away to shut it again.
"What on earth?"
the man said. "Is it thieves?" more incredulous than alarmed.
"No. Stay there, and for God's sake do not stir up the house any further," Lawrence said sharply to the footman who was edging towards the bell-pull. "Enough of a muddle, is it?"
and stopped. Edith was on the stairs, in a dressing-gown and gap, saying,
"Bertram, may I beg you to be as quiet as you can? James is only just asleep."
There was a moment of general uncomfortable silence until Wolvie broke it, saying pompously,
"I think you had better explain yourself, Lawrence, and what you mean by this invasion of my house."
"Nothing," Lawrence said after a moment, "but to keep you from drawing attention from the French on the stoop. We may not be discovered."
His hand was closed and hard upon the pistol in his waist for no good reason. The fool, the damned fool, keeping his wife and child in the middle of an occupying army. Lawrence had no right and knew it, but he could not help but ask,
"Why in God's name have you not left the city?"
"Measles,"
Edith said from the stairs. She had come halfway down from the landing. Her face was composed, but her hand gripped tightly on the railing.
"The doctor said the baby might not be moved."
She paused and added quietly, "The French have not troubled us. One officer came to question us, but they have been perfectly civil."
"Not that we are sympathisers, and if you mean to suggest as much..."
"Wait," Wolvie said,
"haven't I heard... You were..."
He stopped and was plainly stuck for an explanation which Lawrence had not the slightest desire to try and give him.
"You must pardon me, I do not know what you have heard," Lawrence said. "I am most heartily sorry to have troubled you, but we are on an urgent errand, and it is not of a nature to be discussed in your front hall."
"Then come into the sitting-room. Discuss it there," Sutton Leeds said.
He was more than a little drunk, if not to the point of slurring.
"Secret mission? Splendid! I've been aching to do something against these damned frogs, prancing through the city as though they owned it."
Neither was Wolvie sober, or perhaps it was belligerence, but he, with more suspicion, seconded this demand, and added,
"And I tell you, Lawrence, I expect some better answers. No, you shan't go, unless you do want me to set up a shout. You cannot accost a man in the street in times like these, and then claim it is all secret missions, and go bounding away, you with this Chinaman in tow."
"I beg your pardon," Tharkey said, in his most frigidly aristocratic accents, and drew their stairs. "I do not believe we have been introduced, gentlemen."
"What the devil are you doing made up like a Chinaman, then?"
Sutton Leeds said, peering at Tharkey's face, as if he expected to find some artifice responsible for his features. In the brief distraction, Lawrence caught Wolvie's arm and said low and sharply,
"Do not be a damned fool. If they take us in your house, they will take you up as a spy, do you understand? And if they care to be suspicious, your wife also. Forget we were ever here, and pay your servants to do the same. Every moment we stay here, we put you all in danger, to no purpose."
Wolvie wrenched himself free and returned, as coldly,
"That you take me for a fool, I very well know, but I am not so simple as to take the word of a convicted traitor. Yes, I have heard that you are skulking loose in the streets the day after Bonaparte marches in, and all for the benefit of the king."
"Then I am lying in a turncoat for the French," Lawrence said impatiently, "and if you interfere with me, likely I could have you all arrested. Either way, you had better let me go."
"I am not a coward," Wolvie said, "and if you are on some black business for that Corsican, I will stop you if I have to blow a hole in you to do it. Yes, and go to prison for it too, damn you."
"Gentlemen," Edith said, breaking into this charged atmosphere, "I beg you go into the sitting-room before you wake all the house."
And there was nothing to be done for it. Sutton Leeds was disposed of by means of a substantial glass of brandy, which dose left him snoring in an armchair. The credit was Edith's. They had scarcely gone into the room before she had come down again, hastily dressed, and taken the decanter around at once. But though Wolvie accepted his own glass automatically, he then looked at it and set it down, and said,
"I will have coffee, my dear, if you please,"
with a determined mien, and waited for the cup with his arms folded across his chest.
Lawrence looked at the clock. Nearly 11. While Bonaparte and so many of his entourage were engaged at the party, surely gave them their own best chance of success, and every minute was now doubly precious. Tharkey caught his eye and said low, "He has horses," with a jerk of his head at Wolvie, a suggestion which Lawrence did not in the least like. He saw no better alternative, but every feeling rebelled against putting his life, all their lives, in Wolvie's hands, and he did not trust Wolvie's servants not to listen. They remained standing all in silence, except for the continuing low snuffles of Sutton Leeds's snoring. A maid brought the coffee service and took a long while arranging it on the table, covertly glancing up at them all. They made an absurd gathering. Wolvie in his evening dress, Edith in a soft, high-waisted morning gown of clear lawn without stays. She must have snatched it from the closet and put it on alone. Tharkey and himself in their rough workman's clothes, smudged with dirt and stinking, no doubt, of cattle and of the docks.
"Thank you, Martha," Edith said at last. "I will pour,"
and bent over the table when the maid had gone. She gave them cups, or Wolvie and Lawrence. She hesitated a moment and then finally poured another for Tharkey. Tharkey smiled with a faint twist at her doubtful gesture towards him. "Thank you," he said, and drank the coffee quickly. Then, setting down the cup, he went to the door and opened it again. The maid and footman lingering outside made shift to vanish quickly. Tharkey glanced back at Lawrence and meaningfully at the clock. Then he slipped into the hall, closing the door behind him. No one now would be able to come near and eavesdrop. Lawrence put down his own cup of excellently strong coffee and looked at the dark square of the casement window, framed with thick curtains of velvet in pale blue with elegant gold-tasseled cords. He had the unreasonable desire to simply smother Wolvie with one of them and leave him trussed on the floor while they fled. But of course he would begin to shout at once, and Lawrence could not put Edith in such a position.
"Well," Wolvie said, "I'm not going to be put off, Lawrence, and if you keep me waiting any longer, I have a dashed notion to have my footmen put you in the cellar, and there let you sit until morning."
Lawrence compressed his lips on the first several answers he wished to make. He was aware he was unjust. Wolvie had no more reason to love him than the reverse, and no reason to believe him.
"We do not have until morning," he said at last shortly. "Earlier today a British officer was captured, a dragon captain."
"What of it? I hear 10,000 men were captured yesterday."
Wolvie spoke bitterly and with real feeling, one sentiment at least which Lawrence could share.
"It means his beast is taken prisoner too," Lawrence said. "He is hostage for her good behaviour, and his beast is our fire-breather, our only fire-breather."
"Oh," Edith said suddenly, "I saw her this morning. She came down in Hyde Park."
Lawrence nodded.
"And there is some little chance he is yet held at the palace itself," he said. "Do you understand now our urgency? While Bonaparte—"
"I am not a simpleton," Wolvie said, interrupting. "But why only you and this havy-cavy fellow with you?"
"One good man is better than a dozen of lesser ability in such an expedition," Lawrence said. "We were the only ones nearby enough to make the attempt. Now, enough questions," he added sharply. "I'm not going to waste time answering whatever sequence of objections you can dredge up. If you mean to continue this blundering interference, where you have no understanding of the situation, you may be damned. We will take our chances in the street with Bonaparte's guardsmen."
Wolvie looked still undecided.
"Will," Edith said quietly, and they both looked at her, "will you swear on the Bible that you are telling the truth?"
This gesture did not entirely satisfy Wolvie, but Edith took him by the arm and said,
"Dearest, I have known Will since we were little children. I can believe he would have managed to get himself convicted of treason, but not that he would lie under oath."
Suddenly he said,
"Still, it is all a dashed rum affair, if you ask me."
He drew away from her and poured himself a second cup of coffee in an irritable tension that splashed it across the china and the polished wood, and did not bother to put in the cream, but drank it straight from the cup, a few swallows only, and set it down again with a clatter.
"So what is it? Do you mean to rescue him?"
he said abruptly, with a new note of something even more dangerous than suspicion. Enthusiasm.
"If we can," Lawrence said, and forced himself to ask, "if you can spare us your carriage horses?"
"No," Wolvie said after a moment. "No, I will take you in the carriage. Lord Holland's servants know me, and his grounds march with the palace gardens. It is not a mile from his house. If you really mean to get yourselves into the palace, and it is not all a fantasy, I will see you there. And if it is all a pack of nonsense, and you have some other thing in mind, I dare say with a coachman and a couple of footmen we can just as well put paid to your notion."
Edith flinched.
"Wolfie, do not be absurd,"
Lawrence said.
"You have not been brought up for this sort of work."
"Driving you an easy couple of miles to the house of a gentleman of my acquaintance, and then a stroll through his park?" Wolfie shot back, sarcastic. "I dare say I will manage somehow."
"And then," Lawrence said, "when we have gone into the house and taken Granby out, and a hue and cry is raised after us?"
"I am certain I know Kensington Park a damn sight better than you," Wolfie said. "So as for getting out, I have a better chance than you of doing it. What is your next objection?" "I am ready to be as patient as you care to be, Lawrence. You are the one insisting on a hurry."
Wolfie went upstairs to change his clothes, having first taken the precaution of calling down two footmen to watch them while the coach was pulled around.
"Can you not persuade him?"
Lawrence asked Edith, low in a corner. She had her arms folded about her waist, hands gripping at the elbows.
"What would you have me say?" she returned. "I will not counsel my husband to be a coward. Will this not be of assistance to you?"
He could not deny it, and she shook her head and looked away, her lips pressed tight, and Lawrence could not work on her any further.
"I had thought I was done with these fears, anyway," she added, low and unhappily,
but he knew how little her personal feelings would be permitted to sway her judgment, as little as he would have allowed himself. He moved away from her as Wolfie came down the stairs and went to bid her farewell. The two of them stood talking low a little while, hands clasped, and then he bent his head to hers. Tharke was watching the scene with a dry interest.
"I beg your pardon for embroiling us so," Lawrence said. "In a practical sense we could ask for nothing better," Tharke said. "We are not likely to be stopped in a blazoned carriage, bowling away down the street in open view of everyone. Noticed, certainly, and he may find his neck in a noose for it afterwards, but that is his concern, and those who would weep for him."
He looked at Lawrence.
"Although those may be of interest to you also."
Lawrence was sorry to be so transparent, and sorry even more to be shut up in a carriage for half an hour with Wolfie for the drive to Holland House. There was no conversation of any kind. There could be nothing said between them, the rejected suitor and the husband. Lawrence was silenced further by a difficult, inchoate sensation which had no place in the present circumstances, and yet insisted on making itself felt. He had never thought very much of Wolfie before. He had dismissed the man as a spendthrift idler, but in fairness Wolfie had never been given impetus to his own improvement. With nothing to do but spend money, he might easily have fixed himself in a vicious character, a deep gamester, or a selfish coward. But he had chosen instead to establish himself respectably, with a wife no man could blush for, and no coward had acted tonight as he had. If he were a little dull and mulish when he was in drink, and angry for his country's humiliation, that was not the worst thing that could be said of a man. And Edith had looked very well. Not happy. No one could be happy with an army at the door and a quarrel in the entrance hall, but that she was contented with the lot she had chosen was plain. She did not regret. Lawrence wholeheartedly wished her happy. His feeling had not that envious quality, but it was uncomfortable to think Wolfie had brought it about, and, Lawrence was painfully aware, he had not. He had kept Edith on the shelf with expectations, when she might have had more advantageous offers, and their last interview he could not remember with anything like satisfaction. All selfish petulance on his side, the gall even to make her an offer which could only be unwelcome after he had pledged himself to the core. He looked at Wolfie, who was staring out the carriage window. What had Edith to regret? Nothing. She had rather to congratulate herself on a lucky escape. The coach drew to a stop. Holland House was dark, and the horses stamped uneasily, warm breath steaming in the air, while a footman came rubbing sleep from his eyes to hold their heads.
"Yes, I know the family are away," Wolfie was saying, already climbing out as another opened the door for him. "Be so good as to stable my horses and bring Gavin's out. I want a word with him."
He gave airy excuses for his presence in the city and for his visit, the baby ill and squalling, the wife impatient.
"And I thought to myself, what I needed was a walk in the fresh air and to have a look at the stars.
too many lights in Mayfair. Sure, Lord Holland would not mind.
It was a bizarre proposal, at midnight, with an army in the streets and two men in rough clothing behind him, but Gavin's only bowed, familiar with the odd starts of gentlemen in their cups, and too well trained to show it if he were puzzled.
"I must advise you, sir, not to go too close to the east end of the park, if you should walk beyond the gardens," he said. "I'm afraid we have several dragons sleeping there."
"Oh," Wolvie said, and when they had been let into the park, he said in a low undertone,
"What are we to do about the beasts?"
"Walk by them," Tharkay said, blowing out the lantern which they had been given.
"There is no need for you to come, father," Lawrence said. "You have done us a great service already, Wolvie."
"I am not afraid,"
Wolvie returned angrily, and strode on ahead. Tharkay shook his head, and when Lawrence looked at him, said quietly,
"It would be difficult to follow an officer of some public repute in the affections of a woman who loves courage."
It had not occurred to Lawrence that Wolvie meant to display to advantage for Edith's benefit, or in any sense of competition with him.
"My reputation is hardly such as any sensible man would covet."
"It does not call you a coward," Tharkay said. "Whatever has Bertram Wolvie done?"
The grounds immediately near the house were wooded, cedar trees fragrant around them amid the silent denuded oaks and plane trees all crusted with frost. These yielded to broad meadows, hard frozen, and their boot heels crushed the grass like sand underfoot. If their object really had been to observe the stars, they would have been served well. The night was clear and cold and still. The wind had died, and no moon. The dragon interlopers were peacefully snoring, if so could be described, a noise like mill wheels grinding, audible at a quarter of a mile. It did not have that same hollow-chest resonance of the voices of the great combat-weight beasts. There were not many men about, and no fires. It looked to be a company of smaller dragons, couriers, with their solitary captains sleeping huddled up against their sides. As a practical matter, it ought not to have been difficult to simply evade them. Lawrence thought himself well used to the company of dragons by now, and he had not minded the streets of Peking or the pavilions where the great beasts slept in vast, coiled heaps. But in the near absence of light, the persistent, low, churning noise magnified, and he yet could not wholly repress the shudder which climbed his back as they walked from one stand of trees to another, crossing the meadows where the dragons slept. The intellect might know these were thinking creatures who would rather capture than kill him, but his belly did not. It knew only that here, nearby, were a dozen beasts or more which he could not see if they chose to move, and which in the ordinary course of animal life would have made an easy meal of him. They were oddly all the more alarming for their smaller size. A man could not be of much interest to the larger dragons as a meal. So he informed himself in cool, reasoning terms, and nodded back, the whole exchange wholly divorced from his body's involuntary response, where every outline became a dragon, and every grumble of rustling leaves a prelude to attack. And they had yet to keep moving on steadily, through pitch impenetrable enough that Lawrence put out his hand before his face to keep from running into any branches. Wolvie's breath rasped loud ahead of him, ragged, short breaths, and he stumbled occasionally. Tharkay had taken the lead from him, but he kept moving. Lawrence paced breath to footsteps and doggedly followed, as near to blind as he ever hoped to be. A flicker, or not even so much, only some vague impression of movement, made his head snap sideways, and he stopped a moment, watching, trying to make anything. A hopeless attempt, except for what might have been a dark, snaking blot reaching into the sky wherein no stars showed. He quickened a few steps to stop Wolvie and gave a soft hiss to make Tharkay turn and come back again. They waited, crouching, listening. The dragon heaved a great yawning sigh and murmured something in French. Then a quick, flurrying leap, a leathery flap of wings, and it was up and aloft. They did not move while it was audible overhead, and stayed a while longer afterwards, meek rabbits huddling out of the hawk's sight before they could make themselves resume. It seemed a very long time walking before they came at last to another broad rustling stand of trees, comforting, and the ground underfoot abruptly became the loose crunch of finely gravelled and sanded road. They had reached the end of the estate. Across the road, the broad hedge of the palace garden rose like a great blank wall before them, and the gleam of lights distantly visible at either end of the lane, small as fireflies, the guards on watch. But there were none directly ahead, the patrol idling near their sheltered posts. Tharke motioned Lawrence to wait with Wolvie, and after a moment came back to silently guide them to a place he had found by the hedge, a low rock butting up near the wall, and a thick elm branch above. He had already rigged a cord hanging down. Lawrence nodded, and taking off the thick leather apron, threw it over the top of the hedge. The scramble was as quiet as he could make it, one hand for the rope and arms and feet thrusting inconveniently into the thicket of yew, breathing in the fragrant smell of the needles, and then, well clawed, he rolled over its broad, flat top on the protective sheet of the apron, and dropped directly into the garden on the other side, jarringly. Wolvie came after him with some delay, panting heavily and in disarray. The fine buckskin of his breeches, better suited to more decorous use, was torn and blooded. Tharke last, silently and quick, and the great palace lay across a narrow lawn before them, windows full lit, shadows passing back and forth before the lights, and another half a dozen dragons in the way. Not sleeping, either, but couriers wide awake and waiting for messages.
"The stables!" Wolvie whispered, pointing.
The dragons were as far from the low outbuilding as could be managed.
"There is another door on the side, and from there across only a narrow gap to the servants' entrance, to the kitchens."
The horses whickered at them uneasily and stamped, watching with liquid, terrified eyes, but this was evidently no change in their behaviour with the dragons at the door. No one stirred or came to look in at them. Tharke paused at the far door, fingertips resting against the wood. From outside voices came clear, surly, and English. Through a crack, Lawrence peered at a pair of workmen, who were trundling manure to the heap without any evidence of pleasure.
"Psst," he said, softly, when they came close, and the men jerked. "Steady now, men, and quiet, if you love your country." "Aye, sir, only say the word,"
one said, whispering back, an automatic touch of the forelock. A man, badly wall-eyed and with blue ink on his bare forearms, sure mark of the sea. He scowled at the lanky younger fellow with him, whose ready protest subsided instead into silent fidgets and darting sideways looks at them.
"Is there a prisoner here kept?" Lawrence said, "who would have been brought today? A man not 30 years of age, dark-haired?" "Aye, sir," the seaman said. "Brought him in with a guard like he was the king, and to the finest bedroom but the one old bony cop for himself. There was a noise about it right enough, and that beast of his out front wailing fit to end the world. We thought she would have us all on fire. She said she would. She has only gone quiet this last hour."
Lawrence risked it. A quick dash to the corner of the house was enough to confirm Iskierka's presence. She was lying miserably coiled before the house in what had been an elegant formal garden adorned with statuary, and now was a heap of rubble. She no longer wailed, but was gnawing sullenly upon the remnants of a cow, steam issuing from her spines. And she was not alone. Lien was sitting up on her haunches beside her, saying,
"You must know that he cannot be given back to you unless he gives his parole and swears never to take up arms against the Emperor again. There is no sense in your lying here and being uncomfortable. Come away to the park, and you may have something more to eat."
"I'm not going away anywhere without my Granby," Iskierka said, "and he will never do any such thing. And as soon as I have him back, I will kill you and your Emperor, and all of you, only see if I do not. Here, you may keep your nasty cows."
And she threw the mauled remainders of her dinner in Lien's direction. The White Celestial put back her ruff in displeasure for just an involuntary moment, and then nudged up a mound of dirt over the carcass with one talon, careful never to touch the offal.
"I am sorry to see you insist on being unreasonable. There is no reason we should be enemies. After all, you are not a British dragon, you are a Turkish dragon, and the Sultan is our ally, not Britain's."
"I do not give a fig for the Sultan. I am Granby's dragon, and Granby is British," Iskierka said. "And anyway, I have stolen £30,000 of your shipping, so of course we are enemies."
"You may have another 10,000 if you would like to come and fight for us instead," Lien said.
"Ha!"
Iskierka said disdainfully.
I will have another 30,000 instead, and take the prizes myself, and I think you are a spineless coward, too.
The nearest troop of guard were staying back, prudently, and the couple of courier beasts also, all of them with a nervous eye for whatever Iskierka might take it into her head to do, and so a clear path lay open from the house towards her.
"If we can only get hold of him,"
Lawrence said quietly to Tharke, creeping back to the stable door,
"and get him out to the open. Even an upper window might do. Anywhere she might reach us."
"As soon as we are seen by anyone looking like ragpickers, they will set up a howl," Wolvie said.
"Begging your pardon," the seaman said, "but there is six of them cavalry officers sleeping upstairs over the stable in their clothes."
The nervous stable boy they set to watch the door, and Wolvie to watch him.
"Derby, sir, but Janus they call me," the seaman said, "on account of a surgeon we shipped in the Sophie. A learned bloke, saying I saw both ways like some old Roman cut-up by that name. And there I would be still but my girl in the city losing her mum and taking sick, and her with 3-4 mouths to feed," he added,
his excuses with an air defensive and vague. Likely it had been not one girl, but several, and the general lack of them aboard, which had induced him to quietly abandon the sea.
"Very good, Janus,"
Lawrence said, and gave him a pistol. They put out the one lantern, swinging by the door, and at a nod from Tharke the three of them went up the ladder into the loft, one after another, swift on bare feet. The men lay breathing the regular sighs of exhausted sleep, half-sunk into broken-open bales of hay with their sabres and pistols beside them. One after another, Lawrence woke them, a folded pad of leather over their mouths, Janus to pin their heels, and Tharke with a pistol steady in the man's face, and they were turned over and trussed quickly with straps, heaved up onto the stack of bales. The fourth man opened his eyes too soon and managed to drum his heels as they reached for him. The other two roused sluggishly and groped for the missing swords and pistols, which Tharke had already collected away, three of them thrust into his waistband in piratical fashion. It was a short but brutal struggle, even numbers and the necessity of silence driving them. Lawrence went for his knife and grimly put it into the unarmed man's throat as the Frenchman tried to wrestle himself up from the ground. The man sank back, limply, staring up, empty and blind at the ceiling, blood spilling from his neck to soak into the straw. Lawrence took up a sword and killed another quickly, while Janus held him. Tharke dispatched the last. The horses below were stamping again, wickering at the smell of blood.
"Are you all right?" Wolvie whispered,
putting his head up into the loft, and stopped with his mouth a little open.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said shortly, his heart still hammering.
"Go below, and keep that fellow at the door."
Whether because of some note in his voice, or the scene, Wolvie made no protest, but obeyed in silence, vanishing again below. The trussed men fought and kicked as they were turned over and stripped of their coats and cuirasses, and one of them made a low moan behind the gag as his eyes fell on the dead men lying straight. Friends, or brothers, perhaps? Lawrence closed his mind to the thought. Or tried. Wolvie's shocked expression lingered. The hard use, the necessary brutality of the service were not of the same world as England, as home. And it was that division which might let a man be a gentleman and a practical soldier both. But now he was in the stables of Kensington Palace, with his palms wet with blood, on a spy's errand, yet as necessary as any military action. No one could deny its necessity. Let it only take place in Paris, or Istanbul, or China, and Wolvie would read of it in the papers and applaud, though the act were the same or bloodier. But it did not belong here. A black, rotten canker taken root in the warm, sour horse smell of the stable attic above the peaceful gardens. They made shift out of the four scavenged uniforms not overly stained with blood, and Lawrence threw a stable blanket over the men now stripped and bound again against the chill. The coat sat uneasily on his shoulders, warm from a dead man's body, as he climbed down the ladder and gave the last coat to Wolvie.
"We will bind you also," Lawrence said to the boy, "unless you will come along to the rescue and to the dragon."
But the boy shook his head vigorously and preferred to be bound up and thrown into the loft also.
"Perhaps half an hour now,"
Tharke said, meaning how long they might hope for before discovery. Lawrence himself made it likelier a quarter.
"We go in quickly, then," he said, "not running, but with purpose. Do you know where he is, Janus?" "Well, sir," Janus said, shrugging awkwardly inside his coat and looking a poorer match for it than Tharkey. "The maids will sometimes take a fellow up to the better rooms to see, and I don't say I haven't had an invitation or two, but which his room will be, I am sure I can't say." "There will be no difficulty there," Lawrence said. "It will be the door that is guarded."
He went first, with Wulvie beside him. A quick glance would see their faces, and perhaps miss the others behind them. Tharkey had a handkerchief up to his face, as if to catch a sneeze for some more concealment. They went up the back staircase, and at Janus's whisper, turned off the landing into the hallway. Some 8 or 9 men stood in the hall, talking near one of the doors, of a room facing onto the rear of the house. Undoubtedly there would be more guards within. Lawrence did not pause, but kept walking steadily towards them, the men not stiff at their posts, but talking and lounging freely, unalarmed, some sitting on the floor in a game of cards, others crouching by to observe, only a few standing. A maid was coming down the hall past them, loaded down with washing, and picking through the knot of them, had a moment's awkward struggle to win past one over-enthusiastic sergeant who caught at her waist.
"Keep off your hands," she said coldly, and jerked expertly free with a twist of her hips, while the other officers roared with laughter at their fellow's expense.
She won past them at last, cheeks angry with colour and her eyes downcast. Lawrence was nearly even with her now, and as they passed one another he seized one of the sheets from her pile and snapped it open over the entire company. A confused babble of shouting arose at once. They all four rushed the swathed men, toppling the standing men over. The door to the room opened, and another man looked out. Tharkey shot him and kicked the door wide. Granby, warned by the commotion, took the opening at once and came rushing out of the room with a bruised cheek and a bandaged arm.
"Thank God! Give me a pistol!" he said, and threw off the sling. "The window!"
Lawrence said, and turning at the report of a shot, received Wulvie into his arms. There was a startled look on Wulvie's face, and a great stain spreading already through his shirt, visible beneath the swallow-wing lapels of his coat. Another shot fired, and another, bullets coming wild through the sheet, small fires catching in the linen in their wake. The maid, screaming, had fled down the hall.
"Here's Kierke!"
Granby was shouting. He had dashed into the room across the way and was leaning out the window. A look was enough to be sure. The light was already gone from Wulvie's eyes. He was dead weight, sliding to the floor.
"Lawrence!"
Tharkey said, and shot the first French officer struggling out of the tangled sheet.
"Damn you!"
Lawrence said, not very certain if he meant Wulvie or the man who had shot him, or indeed himself. He, stooping, worked the wedding ring from Wulvie's hand and went after Tharkey into the bedroom. They shut the door and barricaded it with a wardrobe overturned. It would hold only a moment, but they needed no longer. Iskierka's talons were already seeking at the window, scrabbling and tearing away glass and masonry and brick in great shattering blocks.